You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hi, Sarah Custer here. In this podcast, we bring you a debrief from our team who is recently out in Shenzhen, China for the Times Higher Education Asia University Summit. And then after that, we bring you some post-event commentary from our reporter, Rachel Pels, who spoke with Alice Gast, Vice Chancellor of Imperial College London, Tirtha Raj Kania, Vice Chancellor at Tribhuvan University in Nepal, Joe Beal, Director of Education and Society at the British Council, and Mike Ward, Head of the Chemistry Department at the University of Warwick. Enjoy!
Hello and welcome to a Times Higher Education podcast. This week, coming to you from a hotel in Shenzhen, mainland China. We're about an hour north of Hong Kong for people who've never heard of Shenzhen before, but I'm sure you will soon. We have been here hosting the Asia Universities Summit, and I am joined by Phil Beatty, Editorial Director of Times Higher Education World University Rankings, and Rachel Pels, one of our reporters who's come to the summit to capture some of the conversations. My name is Tim Savula, Head of Content and Engagement for the World Summit Series. And we would like to talk about some of the highlights from the summit. I will start off hearing from Phil and his perspective of launching the rankings and a rather special encounter with a drone.
Yeah, that's right. We launched the Asia Rankings 2018 in front of about 400 people at a massive gala dinner in the centre of Shenzhen, and they delivered the rankings on a drone. It was a rather nerve-wracking experience because I hadn't rehearsed. I wasn't particularly expecting it.
Could have been assassinated.
It was quite frightening.
Tunes of Wagner coming over the PA, Ride of the Valkyries.
A little bit of a spectacle, but I think actually it was appropriate to make it a spectacle because there was a sense of celebration. You know, the rankings have 25 Asian nations or regions celebrated. It's a fantastic show of the strength and diversity of the Asian region. So it was appropriate to have a bit of pomp and ceremony and a bit of fun with the launch.
And what was the reaction to some of the rankings? What were the feedback you had from the people you spoke to?
Well, I think it was relatively predictable. We had NUS Singapore in the number one position for the third year in a row. I think that's thoroughly deserved, very widely expected. Probably the eye-catching element at the top of the rankings was that Tsinghua and Peking swapped places. Tsinghua moved ahead of Peking University for the first time since we've ever done the Asia rankings. But it really seemed to be in keeping with local expectations. Tsinghua is a little bit more focused, not as wealthy as Peking. A bit more focused on STEM, a bit more industry engaged, and traditionally more international. And it just pipped Peking very, very marginally on some of our some of our indicators around productivity, internationalization. But overall, it was a bit of a cliched story as well. Really, it was all about the rise of China. If you include Hong Kong and mainland China together, they have half of the top 10. They have numbers 2, 3, 4. 5 and 6 in the ranking. Chinese U, Hong Kong entered the top 10 for the first time, but China really just dominated quite dramatically. Japan has more institutions overall than mainland China, but they're not performing as strongly. Their average scores are quite a significant amount lower.
And Rachel, the people you spoke to at the summit, were they only interested in talking about rankings with you, or what were some of the other conversations you had or topics they wanted to bring up?
Yeah, I mean, people always are interested in talking about rankings, but for me, the most interesting part was meeting all these delegates from all over the world and talking to them about the different challenges that they face in their institutions. It was my first Times Higher Education Summit, so I was just amazed and excited to meet so many different people from so many different places. I sat in on a session on the second day of the summit with some vice chancellors and academics from emerging economies, which was really interesting just to hear about, because you hear a lot about the rise of China and how successful these Eastern countries have been in recent years, but there are still vast differences in how Southeast Asian countries are faring in terms of political challenges, funding, and and producing the and retaining the best student graduates.
I think that's actually one of the really interesting things about the Asia Summit, in the fact that, you know, we have a big focus. Clearly the rankings are dominated by East Asia, but the actual rankings themselves contain 35 countries. You know, we go as far west within Asia up to Lebanon and the University of Beirut there. And so actually the summit with 400 people there, there was a really huge diversity of perspectives and universities operating in very different, you know, regulatory frameworks, you know, coping with very different demographic challenges. You know, we had, as you say, that session had the rector of University of Phnom Penh, the vice chancellor of the University of Colombo. These are two countries that, you know, relatively recently had, you know, horrendous conflict in those countries. So, you know, the roles of their institutions and, you know, producing research and trying to rebuild their economies is, you know, radically different from, you know, universities in Japan, for example. Phil, you chaired a session with Subra Suresh, you know, one of the world's most eminent scientists and university leaders, who's recently, just last month, January the 1st, started his new role at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. What were some of the things that came out from Suresh's analysis of global research and education trends?
I think he set the scene fantastically. He was the opening keynote. And I think what was really interesting about that was that he spent a lot of his career in the US. He was running Barack Obama's Science Council. He was president of Carnegie Mellon for some time. And he kicked off really reminding us of those essential foundation blocks for American research excellence. The 1950s, the post-war period, where they established the sort of basic government funding for basic research. This actual relatively new concept at the time that research was a fundamental public good, it deserved government backing, government money. And it really highlighted the power and the importance of basic curiosity-led research and the transformational power that has, and the need to protect and fund that kind of activity. And there was a sense, I think, in the room that most of the phenomenal success you see in places like Singapore and in China and South Korea, that the research has been driven with a bit more of an applied approach, much more geared to economic growth, much more attuned to the short-term economic needs of these countries that are rapidly rising, moving from manufacturing economies into knowledge and innovation economies. So it was quite an important reminder, and it also highlighted, I think, the challenge for some of these fantastic East Asian nations to make sure that they build a culture of curiosity-driven research on top of this very fantastically successful applied research to really get to that next level. There was a lot of talk about, you know, the likes of Tsinghua and Beida and other top universities surpassing the top US institutions. So far, they're not in the top 20 in the world. They're very close, and that might be part of the process there. There was a nice line. He said that getting the balance right was really important between fundamental and applied. He mentioned that we'd sent a man into space before we'd put wheels on a suitcase, and that was the sort of good epitome of practical applied research ideas and innovations versus the big moonshot type activities.
Yeah, he had that slide, I think, showing the patent for the wheelie suitcase, which was filed in, I think, 1973. So perhaps, I think, I know on our way to Hong Kong what I'm going to value more in terms of in terms of going back. And then closing the day, I had the privilege of being with Alice Gast, the president of Imperial College London, and she had a really great session that was all talking about leading from AlphaGo and the experiment or work with DeepMind, the Google-owned company, to produce artificial intelligence that could defeat the world's greatest Go player. There's actually a brilliant documentary on Netflix that I happened to catch last week all about that process. But she was talking about pursuing the endless frontier of knowledge in the era of artificial intelligence, which stimulated a lot of questions from the audience. One of the points that I thought was quite interesting, she was talking about the use of algorithms by recruiters and how it's helping for them to filter out a recruitment process. But the question was put to her as a consequence that if that is taken on a macro level and starts to affect employment around the world, so that, you know, you'd have hundreds of millions of people first having their skills assessed by a computer, that could lead to quite a negative understanding of artificial intelligence by wider non-science and research-based population, and how universities therefore would have to work more closely with, you know, sociologists and ethicists to sort of work out how the impact of artificial intelligence can be embraced and welcomed rather than be seen as a threat. Rachel, what were some of the points that you made from that session? I think you've got a story on timeshighereducation.com right now, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I caught up with Alice Gast after her speech. I thought it was really interesting, the points that you both made about using algorithms to recruit, and how businesses and universities like might use AI in the future. And I asked her if we can expect universities to cut out the middleman, and in the future, will we just see an automated recruitment process? Will there be all the same interviews for potential Oxbridge graduates, for instance, or will students just be facing a series of computer games, essentially, which, you know, computers are becoming so advanced now that we can always depict a person's characteristics and whether they'll be suitable for a course without having to meet another human being. And yeah, she was quite bold in saying that we can definitely expect that, and AI is inevitable, we have to just embrace it now. But she was also quick to say that there's always going to be a need for human contact, and I think she didn't go so far as to say that, you know, will never need to speak to any humans in the admissions process again. I think those human qualities, compassion, will always be needed.
I remember Peter Hoge, the Vice Chancellor of the University of Queensland, saying on stage on the Tuesday morning that the greatest contribution that universities make and create is human talent. Mm. You know, and he was very specific about including human in that output.
It's interesting, Tim, that you talk about the potential perceptions and negative perceptions of AI. I mean, that's maybe giving away my age, but my cultural reference point for AI was the Terminator, where the robots destroyed humanity. So I think we do need to make sure there's lots of humanities research involved in how we understand and develop AI, and we try and retain some humanity.
I did think it was noticeable to me that one of the things that all the university leaders and senior researchers spoke about was very much about the impact of AI and things on their students and their faculty and their staff and their research. But I don't think anyone mentioned, you know, sort of the wider world beyond that. You know, I mean, I would perhaps want to ask a question about, well, what about the people who aren't going to university at all? Or equally, what about the people who aren't going to university because they've already graduated, or, you know, they're in their 30s, their 40s, you know, there's this issue about reskilling, you know, the labour force, essentially, and maybe that's a big subject for the future summit of how we can work out making the impact of AI a bit of a softer impact, perhaps, on the world beyond the university campus.
Yeah, there's a lot of conversation about the fourth industrial revolution and, you know, how universities need to rethink the way they educate people. And, you know, not just the content, the curriculum, but actually the whole teaching techniques, the types of delivery. And I think that's going to be a big topic of conversation in Glasgow in July, when we have our first ever Teaching Excellence Summit with the University of Glasgow.
Absolutely. Rachel, have you got any closing memories from the summit before we pack our wheelie suitcases and go on to Hong Kong Airport?
I found it really interesting. I mean, what we've just said then, that ties into the conversation of open borders as well. A resounding feature of the summit for me was everyone seemed to be on the same page in terms of, you know, with the fourth industrial revolution on its way and already here, some would argue, the need to keep human movement and the ability to keep borders open so that students can actually experience other cultures and still integrate successfully was really strong for me. And also, just again, like we said, being able to meet different university leaders and academics from different cultures and see how those conversations progressed was really interesting. I mentioned that I sat in on the emerging economies panel, where some of the Southeast Asian and one Russian university representative were discussing the challenges that they face compared to these other enormous economies such as China. And one of the main issues there was emerging economies like Sri Lanka, Cambodia, they really struggle to get that connection with business, with industries, between business and universities. But something that was really positive for me that came out of that was speaking to the Vice Chancellor from Sri Lanka afterwards. He said that someone had approached him after that conversation and actually offered to provide some funding and have a conversation about a partnership. So that's such a positive outcome, I think, and just one of the examples of how a summit like this, bringing all these different people together, can spark some really, really interesting conversations.
I think that's just a brilliant thing about the summit. It's not just a talking shop, it's actually a networking opportunity. It's a gathering of really, really fascinating people running universities, taking them out of their immediate day jobs to explore new partnerships, new relationships, new ideas. It's a perfect summary of what's brilliant about the THE World Summit Series.
Yep, I think that's absolutely right. I very much hope that's not something that can be replaced by an algorithm anytime soon. So we are hoping to edit and make some of the conversations, some of the keynotes available as future podcasts. So please watch out for that. You can, of course, read Rachel's coverage from the summit, which is being published at the moment on timeshighereducation.com. And there'll be some future highlights also published in our magazine. We've got photos from the summit. Some videos will be available. So thank you very much for listening today. And we look forward to talking to you again from our next summit, which will be in Jeddah. So thanks very much. That's me, Tim, Phil and Rachel signing up from Shenzhen. Goodbye.
Will AI replace the admissions process in universities one day? Is that something we can expect?
You know, I think that AI will augment the admissions process. As it is, we do the best we can with the inputs we have for students. And I think that the more we can use, the beauty of AI is seen in that example for the Rescue Global, for the emergency response. Integrating disparate sources of information that may be aerial photographs as well as social media feed as well as on the ground reports, and taking all that and helping the humans make decisions in those cases in a very rapid time frame. I think that we can use some of that integrative analysis to help humans make those admissions decisions.
And in that same vein, there are, I suppose, it's easy to scaremonger and say, oh, the rise of robots, you know, one day there'll be no need for teachers, lecturers will be replaced or ruled by robotics. Is that far-fetched? What skills can we still, what skills are going to be most important for us as humans, especially in the university environment?
I still think that that machines are great at very analytic analysis, decision-making, pulling facts together and assisting us, especially when there's a large amount of information to process. But humans bring their emotions, their judgment, their own life experiences, and their human qualities to the equation. And I think it's that combination, that collaboration, that will be quite powerful.
And in your experience, what can UK universities and Western universities learn from Asia and other growing economies?
I think that, again, the power of investment is absolutely clear, that the rise of Asian universities on a relatively short time frame is absolutely seen through the investments that have been made from their governments, not only building infrastructure, but investing in people and creating vibrant communities and supporting them effectively. And so we need to make sure that we're keeping that investment at the highest levels that we can.
anything they could learn from us.
Yes, and I think that we have a great heritage with tremendous values and a heritage that really brings the research university into its place in society in ways that are beyond just looking for economic development or very quick returns and expectations need to be balanced, and that long-term view is very important to take.
So, your name is?
Tirtharaj Khania, Vice Chancellor, Tribhuvan University, a very large university in Nepal, and we have been told that it could be one of the largest universities in the world, maybe top 10, in terms of shape and size and national coverage.
Wow. And how many students do you have?
About or more than 400,000.
400,000?
400,000.
And what are the biggest challenges that you face?
Yeah, well, I think it's a public university. Students don't pay much. That's why we have a financial problem.
Yeah.
Because students tend to think that it's the government university and government has to give us the required financial support. But the government hasn't been able to give us as much as we need. Then is one of the problems is the finance.
Yeah.
Another is it's highly politicalized.
Right.
This university fought for the last several decades to establish democracy and the republic. Then our students are highly politicalized.
Mm.
Most students have, student leaders have become politicians, ministers, prime ministers.
So you're really the source of all of...
We run the country in the sense that it is our alumni who are running the whole country in the bureaucracy, in technical field, in politics.
Yeah. And are they very committed then? Do you get many students leaving Nepal for other countries once they graduate?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I wonder if you were in one of those talks this afternoon, they were saying, given the impact of Trump and Brexit as well, a lot of students are not going there anymore.
It's being discussed among our students because it could be a threat.
Right.
For many Nepali students studying in the US.
That's a shame. So are many more staying in Nepal because of that?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So actually the effects of Trump and politics in the West could reduce your brain drain.
Yeah,
I wanted to know, it was interesting what Stuart said on the panel about how, I think you picked up on it as well, the British universities need to, I can't remember his exact wording, we need to stop thinking of ourselves as central to, you know, global leaders as such. Do you agree? And is that something that, you know, is there a smugness in UK universities? Do we need to look more globally?
So I think UK universities have been rightly proud of their position globally, and we, as the UK, have punched above our weight for a long time.
Mm.
And given the size of our population and number of institutions and so on, to be second to the US has been pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And I think we have spent a lot of time as well having to promote ourselves internationally because of the visa issue and because we are constantly trying to say that the UK is open for business to international students and with Brexit to international scholars in Europe as well.
Yeah.
So that's put us into promotional mode, if you like. And I think it's high time we moved off that promotional platform and listened and engaged increasingly as co-producers of research, as co-investigators of shared problems. And I think that will make us more worthy and interesting partners to universities and university ecosystems around the world.
What could we be learning from universities in Asia?
First of all, I think what we can learn is speed, focus, and a sense of purpose and determination.
Right.
The university we are standing in was built and is operating within 7 years and has already got its first cohort of graduate students.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And one of our Chinese delegates at this conference asked me with a sense of incredulity, why is it taking so long to decide where to have a runway, to even build a runway at Heathrow? And it's very difficult to explain that in a country where it's so can-do, where investment is huge,
yeah,
and where government is pushing. So what can we learn from Asia? We can learn to have a coherent, simple higher education system. We can learn that being open is good. As Stuart Corbridge said today, India is suffering from having had a closed national system and not been open to international partners.
Sure.
And China learnt a few decades ago that being open is the way to go. So we could learn about openness, and it would be a timely reminder,
yeah,
in the UK. What Asia could learn from us, university autonomy,
okay,
is something that we hold very dear and very precious, and that comes with costs, because that means decentralised and institutionalised democracy. And there's always a tension in the UK between university autonomy and decision-making and being part of a whole national ecosystem. I think we could learn to have better dialogue with government. I think government could learn from Asia that more R&D is better for the country, for industry and society, as well as for universities. And I think what we all need to keep an eye on is the continued importance of the humanities and social sciences.
Absolutely.
Because otherwise a sterile STEM world will not create the cities and environments or towns that people teaching in universities will want to live in. If there's no theatre, there's no music.
Yeah.
If there's no greenery and sports facilities, no local democracy and community engagement, then universities won't be supported by a good ecosystem. So those are some of the lessons that I've learned and have come to mind over the last 24 hours.
Mike, you
yes.
are from which university?
I'm from the University of Warwick, where I'm a professor of chemistry and head of the chemistry department.
And what brings you here to the summit?
What brought me here was a suggestion from my boss, the Deputy Vice-Chancellor, that Warwick should have representation at this conference, and she couldn't go, so did I fancy a trip to China. And I thought, well, why not?
Why not, indeed.
And it's turned out to be very interesting.
So what have you learned over the last 48 hours about what the UK and Western universities could learn from countries like China and other emerging economies?
The thing that struck me most is that this is the first conference I've been to for 30 years that wasn't a chemistry conference, which shows you how insular it's very easy to get when you're buried in an academic discipline, so that everything that I've thought about during my professional career as a researcher and as a head of department has been very much subject-focused. So to see a big picture like this for the first time and become involved in discussions about the role of universities and possibilities for collaboration that aren't just in my little silo has been really interesting. So the thing I enjoyed most about the content of the conference was the two keynote speakers on Tuesday, from the president of Nanyang University in Singapore and the president of Washington University, who gave completely different perspectives about the importance of internationalisation and the importance of localisation. So one of them explained very well the importance of having a global reach and international partnerships, and the other one explained very well the importance of universities to the local community and local partnerships. So the range of interactions that successful universities have to have goes from a few miles away to the far side of the world. That's what I really enjoyed particularly about yesterday, the contrast between those two talks, which are both brilliant in their own right, but just gave completely opposite focuses.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.